This is a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.
Well, the theme of the article that you've seen and of my talk was really created by Al Bandura's visit to Cornell as the Henry Ricciuti lecturer. Many of you know Henry, 93, still going strong, shows up in the office most days. And we've now had three exceedingly distinguished scholars speak in his honor, which has been wonderful for the department and for Henry. It's especially nice that Henry's here to appreciate it and to greet the people and vice versa. I was particularly struck by the fact that when Al Bandura came, he talked about outreach. He didn't call it that, but that's what it was. And just to sort of put that in context, there was a survey done a few years ago of psychologists asking them who were the most eminent psychologists of the 20th century. The results were Sigmund Freud, Jean Piaget, Al Bandura, B.F. Skinner. It went on. I mean, he is, by that count, the most distinguished living psychologist in the world today. And given an opportunity to speak at Cornell University, he didn't talk about his latest lab experiment. He talked about how his research was being used to make people's lives better in Latin America and Africa. And he didn't just talk about it as, oh, isn't it wonderful that they've picked up my research? He really gave an analytical account of how that worked, which I thought was very helpful for framing what it means to do research-based outreach. I think this is an important topic because of the contrast between the way we need to think about this topic now and the way we have traditionally. Mon was here when I came, but he'd only been here for a year or so. So I've been around a while. traditionally, extension said we are research-based because the information we had to give out came from research. And that's still important. That puts us ahead a lot of sources of information. But it's not enough anymore. There's a second way. Actually, I have slides on this, so I should probably use this. excuse me, I'm going to need to use my water over here. Thanks. So sometimes that research-based content took the form of experts giving advice. The agronomist who could come out and meet with a group of farmers and help them grow more corn per acre. In the best instances, that agronomist would not just be able to talk in general terms, but we'd be able to say, my colleagues and I have done studies, and we can tell you on the soil type that you have with the amount of rainfall that you get, you need to use X number of pounds of nitrogen per acre to get maximum yield with these seeds. I mean, all those variables, we've studied them, and we can tell you, based on our research, how to do this better. But there's another level of research-based content that, again, is is more current than I did a study and here's what I found. And that is, the consensus of the research on this topic is the following. Well, and then there's a step beyond that that some of you are familiar with, I know, which is not just I have read the research and here's what it says, but rather is a meta-analysis. Meta-analysis is a statistical technique through which an investigator doesn't just read the studies, but takes the data from each study and pools the data, treats all of those studies as if they were one large study, and then comes out with not just, well, this study says this, but this study says that, but on the basis of all of this evidence, here's what we found. Now, in medicine, this is increasingly common, and when they talk about evidence-based practice in medicine, they are referring to formal panels of experts who come together and systematically read the literature and perform meta-analyses when that's possible. It isn't always, there is not always enough, and then come out with their findings in terms of what works and how well under what circumstances for whom, all of those kinds of things. So that's what we're really aiming toward, is not just, there was a study that said this, or I know a lot about this topic, therefore, but rather, there's been a lot of research done here, and that research has established these findings. Tentatively, of course. That's one of the things you always have to understand about research, is that it doesn't tell you the truth. It tells you the best thing we know right now. The next study may blow it all out of the water. This is one of the problems that we have as communicators of scientific research to non-scientific audiences, that there's a tendency, and the newspapers reinforce this, and the news reports, you know, here's the latest study, this is it. Now we know everything we need to know about nutrition. And then, you know, a week later, another study comes out, and it's different. Well, that's the way science works. The goal, though, is to have our content based not just on one study, but on multiple studies, not just on a kind of casual reading of the research, but on a systematic review and ideally a meta-analysis. All those are good, not enough anymore. That was the next one. There's another way in which we have been able to claim and should be able to claim that what we are doing is research-based, and that is that we have evaluated what we're doing. So we have some basis for believing that not just the content, but the way in which we are going about delivering that content or working with people. I mean, sometimes the content isn't really in the lead. It's things like how do you organize, how do you help? I just heard the last of what Mon was talking about, but I assume it had to do, how do you help informal caregivers do a better job with their kids? Well, content is part of that. But part of it, too, is how do you get to those people and how do you get them together and how do you get them networked so there are mutual support. So it's not just content. But we need to know, does that work? Is that a good thing to do? And the way we usually do that is to ask the people who were there what they thought of the experience. When I arrived here, 34 years ago, I had just been, during my last year of graduate study, I'd just been working part-time as an evaluation researcher. And I was very much struck by the fact that in extension at that time, an evaluation meant precisely this. Didn't mean anything else. There's nothing wrong with this. It's very helpful. You ought to do it. But it's not adequate as an evaluation. You really want to have some kind of evidence, and there's a whole, you know, there are tomes written on what kind of evidence, that you met your objectives. I could go off on another talk right now, but I'm going to control myself. There's a more demanding and comprehensive way of looking at the relation of research to outreach and extension. And that starts with what we sometimes call a needs analysis. Research ought to inform or determine the magnitude and distribution of the problem, the issue, the condition that the program, that the intervention is intended to address. Here again, back in the day when I came in, every extension plan began with a situation statement. Some of you may remember situation statements. They usually took the form of, you know, Jackson County has a population of 320,000 people. It has 137 dairy farms and a couple of things like that, and then you'd go on to the program that had absolutely nothing to do with the situation. I mean, you could have written the program for New York City, and the description of there was a mismatch there. That's very different from really looking carefully if your program is aimed at informal caregivers of young children. Well, how many of them are there? Who are they? Where are they located? How many children per household are we talking about? How many of them are legal and how many of them are informal? All of these kinds of issues could be important as a basis for starting your program. And so you use research in this way to establish priorities among problems and to identify target audiences. Now, some of this research may be original work that you do, but it may be using statistics that are available or using somebody else's study. Maybe there's a county planning study that addresses some of the things you have. As I talk about the research that you do, I need to say quickly, I'm talking here about an ideal, and part of what I learned from Al Bandura is that we're not Al Bandura. I hadn't known that before. He didn't do all of the research that went into these projects he described. There were multiple people doing multiple kinds of research, and that's part of the lesson that I'm saying here. So as I'm talking, I don't want you to feel, you know, smaller and smaller and more inadequate. I'm trying to talk in system terms about what we ought to be aiming for and to sort of paint an ideal here, not to say, here's what you have to do every time you have a program back home. Unrealistic. But you can call upon data sources and available research to help you pin down what you're talking about in addressing a program. So that's a first step. Another one is something you certainly won't do yourself, but we ought to have research that tells us, where does this problem come from? What's the source of the problem? And where is it happening among what populations and what proportions? These are medical terms, but they're appropriate for many of the kinds of things we talk about. If we're dealing with teenage pregnancy, we have to know whether girls aren't using contraception or are having babies because they don't see any reason not to. Those are two different etiologies of the problem. And if you aim your program at one and the real problem is the other, you're going to miss. And you know that before you even start. You don't need to do an experiment to find that out. You need to use the available research to try to answer those questions so that you have empirically validated knowledge to incorporate into your program design. Here's where Al Bandura's research came in. And one of the intriguing things about his talk was he said this informally afterwards, that when he talks about these things, people say, oh, how often do you go to Africa? He said, I don't go to Africa. People read my research and then used it to design these programs. So again, it's helpful to remember that these are not steps that one superhuman being, even more superhuman than Al Bandura, does alone. These are steps that require multiple people working together. So you don't have to do this research yourself. You can remember the psychology you had, the education courses you had, but the program ought to be guided by what we know about how people think, how people learn, how behavior changes. Now, in Al Bandura's case, you may know, well, in fact, if you've had introductory psychology, you've read something about Al Bandura, his best-known experiment that is almost in almost every textbook is with the Bobo doll. Does the Bobo doll ring a bell? So a Bobo doll is an inflatable toy about this high with a weighted bottom, and if you just put a child in to play with the Bobo doll, the child tends to play with it. If the child watches another child punching the Bobo doll, the child punches the Bobo doll. Now, a lot of people use this and are very worried about violence being modeled. I happen to think a Bobo doll is designed to be punched, and so maybe that's because I'm a boy. That's something like that. But the point is, people learn by watching other people. That's a very powerful way to change behavior, by modeling. On a more positive side, and it goes both ways. It's not just doing terrible things like punching an inanimate balloon that pops back up when you punch it. If you put a Confederate on the highway changing a flat tire, and you put another Confederate on the highway a mile before changing a tire where someone has clearly pulled over and helped the person changing the tire, somebody is twice as likely to stop for the next car than if there's nobody there modeling the helping behavior. They've done this, literally done that. This is not just stuff you do in the laboratory. They've gone out on the highway and done it, and the effect is very powerful. People tend to say, oh, I could do that too. Not, they don't say it. It's preconscious. They're not reasoning about this, but they tend to learn from models. Now, Bandura found it's not just modeling, but if you want to change people's behavior, it helps to have three different kinds of models: a positive model, a negative model, and a transitional model. So in the soap operas, they prefer to call them serial dramas, but most of us would recognize them as soap operas, television or radio, that have been used in these developing countries as tools for the improvement of health, a better treatment of women, more use of contraceptives. In those soap operas, they have a person who is modeling what you don't want to see, mistreating women or having more children than she can take care of. They have another model who is demonstrating the desired behavior. But then there's someone who is gradually, over the course of these events, these installments in the drama, is moving from the negative to the positive side. And having those three kinds of models has a more powerful influence on behavior than having either any one of them. And the people who wrote the scripts for these serial dramas used that technique. So that's an example of, but it's not the only example. Bandura's approach is certainly not alone. There's a whole arena of cognition, how people learn. There are other theories that have also been demonstrated, have been validated by research. But Bandura's is one of the most powerful ones and one of the best known, and that's the one that they used. Now, they also did a lot of what I think of as market research. They didn't just throw these things out and hope for the best. They actually did surveys and interviews and focus groups with members of the audience to find out. They would make a model, a character who was supposed to be a transitional model and was supposed to be attractive, but then they would ask people how they liked the characters, which ones they admired, what they liked about them or didn't like about them, what they didn't admire. Sometimes they missed. The people writing the script thought they were doing one thing, but it wasn't getting through. So they did this kind of market research to help reshape, refine, and improve the programs that they were putting out over the air. This notion of using market research techniques is a very important one, and one that is used in health. There's a whole field called social marketing that some of you may be familiar with, and when you see ads about tobacco, of stopping smoking cigarettes, that's a form of social marketing. They're using commercial techniques to try to influence health behavior. So it has a social purpose, not a commercial purpose. Excuse me. There's also social marketing done around political campaigns. When you are doing market research to find out what kinds of positions will be attractive to people, or what even what kinds of candidates will be attractive to people. So you can use those techniques that marketers have developed to try to sell us things to try to help people do positive things as well. So what happens within the social drama, the serial drama itself, is one level of concern that research can address, but there's a kind of meta level that has to do with how does this program get spread? How do we do this in multiple places? And there's a whole field of diffusion research. And this is another one of those places where I sort of aha went on. When Bandura was talking about the research that was done in Tanzania, where because they couldn't afford to broadcast the serial dramas in the whole country, they broadcast them in half of the country and saw condom use increase by a factor of 10. And then they moved to the other half of the country and broadcast the serial dramas, and condom use went up by a factor of 10 there too. Now that's about as good as it gets in terms of an experiment to show that it's your intervention that's making the difference. The person who designed and conducted that study was Everett Rogers. Everett Rogers basically invented the field of diffusion of innovations, and his exemplar of innovation diffusion is cooperative extension. You've heard of early adopters when you're talking about innovation, the spread of innovations. That's his term, and he developed it in looking at how farmers adopt changes in agricultural practices, hybrid seeds, and that sort of thing. And cooperative extension has been in that business longer than anybody else. And Rogers has called attention to that. And a lot of people look at cooperative extension as kind of the exemplary organization that knows about this process. That's the good news. Part of the bad news, I thought, was, well, isn't it great when you have Everett Rogers working on your project with you? Now we've got Bandura and Rogers. No wonder the rest of us haven't gotten there yet. The other part of it is that of all of the steps I'm talking about, this is probably the one that remains the most mysterious. The William T. Grant Foundation recently funded an outfit in, I think it's the University of South Florida, called the National Center for Research on Dissemination. They do research on the dissemination of programs, how you take a program and spread it. Their report said, what we know is what doesn't work. We haven't figured out yet what works. What doesn't work is training and technical assistance. This is a little hard to take when you are responsible for programs that use training and technical assistance as their means of diffusion. That's the research is not very supportive of the ways in which we try to diffuse programs. What we know is you can get programs started, you can evaluate them, you can even do experiments to say, yes, we are very confident that this program has these results. We don't yet know how to make those programs grow. Some of them do, but we're not sure how that happens. And information dissemination by itself is a very weak form of dissemination. That's something we have to struggle with. I mean, here we are as cooperative extension. We're probably the best in the business, and we rely too heavily, at least as the research would tell us, on information dissemination believing that if we put it out there, people will first of all, take it in, they will believe it, they will use it to change their behavior, and once they have done that, the results we have in mind will occur. That's a whole chain of assumptions that hasn't been well established empirically. This is even more important now than it was 30 years ago, because we have been going through a period in our history, in the development of the world, from when cooperative extension began, even before I was a part of it, information was scarce. And good, solid, university-based, research-based information was a highly valued commodity. I don't have to tell you that that's changed. Information is everywhere. There's too much information. So simply putting more information out there is even less effective now than it was 100 years ago or 30 years ago. There's too much information. We've got to be more sophisticated about what we do with the information we have, which is, again, why simply saying, oh, well, we have research-based content, bully for you. That's good. That's a starting point. What are we going to do with the research-based content? How are we going to use it to achieve the goals that we've set? Okay, and then we have evaluation research. Remains important, as does, and I don't mean to belittle the importance of research-based content. I simply say we can assume that. That's our stock in trade. It's not enough. and evaluation research is important not only for saying, yeah, the program worked, but in the formative purpose of aiding in the refinement and improvement of the program. So you can use evaluation research to get feedback from audiences. That's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. You want to know something about what did your audiences look like and were they the audiences that you identified up front? I mean, if you've said, here are the people who have the problem, then you want to know, is it those people you got to? Or was it somebody else? Or was it the people who work with them? That's another way you might do it. And, of course, you want to know whether there was a change in impact and in attitude, but most important, was there behavior change? So all of this is a very tall order. It's not only that there are multiple people who have to be involved, but one of the things that is striking to me is that there are multiple disciplines. There are multiple kinds of research. Market researchers are very different kinds of people from laboratory researchers. But what Bandura's sort of schema reinforced was the fact that there isn't one kind of research that is going to guide us all the way through this process. There are multiple kinds of research and therefore multiple kinds of researchers who need to be involved. This is one of the things that's become clearer to me in my role as Associate Provost for Outreach, but also in my continuing role as a faculty member in human development who is committed to doing outreach, and that is we need to move more in the direction of what's known as big science, heavily funded, large projects that have multiple investigators. Our department has a tradition of individual investigators or individual investigators with their graduate students and occasionally group projects. The Family Matters Project that Lon Cochran was associated with, Uri Bronfenbrenner, Claire Forrest, is a good example of a multi-investigator project. Yuri brought his friend Ed Devereaux, a sociologist, along, Bill Cross, another psychologist, Mon, very much an applied researcher, and together they developed this project. We don't do that often enough, and this is something I'm just saying to you. You can't do anything about that. That's our challenge. The positive side of that challenge is that the funding agencies, particularly the National Institutes of Health, are increasingly interested in precisely these kinds of projects that touch on the whole range of research from the problem identification to the issues of whether you've gotten to the audience you want and whether your intervention worked. We need to figure out how to capitalize on the strengths we have on campus to do that exactly that kind of research. And then, of course, not just to inform you, but to involve you in that entire process. The best example we have of that at this point is in New York City with the Weill Cornell Medical School, which has a $50 million grant from NIH for translational research. And Jackie and her colleagues are not just receiving results from that, but are partners from the very beginning. And that's another way in which the relationship between research and outreach must change. That is, it's not just the researchers doing a better job of research and then saying to the outreach folks, okay, here's what we found, go use it, but collaboration, partnership between researchers and people who do outreach from the very beginning. Good.
So it works
during... I remember Elaine was going to talk about that. I want to make clear that I'm not trying to put a burden on you and saying you've done everything wrong, you've got to do things differently. This is a system-wide issue, and some of the things that we need to do include this collaboration process I was just talking about. There is something that you can do more of. I say that recognizing that I'm a professor, I'm supposed to have time to read, and I don't have enough time to read nearly as much as I should. Try to think of it as part of your professional responsibility, not taking time off from your work, but doing your work in a professional manner, to read or browse. I mean, realistically, a lot of this is going to be on a computer screen. It's more efficient than having to go to the library. I actually have been to the library a couple times in the last few weeks. I really like it, but it's hard. It's hard to do that. The challenge here is that there's too much out there and you don't have enough time, but think about what sense it makes to try to develop a new program or try to diagnose a program that you're running without having any idea what other people have done or learned about this. I mean, if you want to talk about a waste of time, that's pretty wasteful. You really should find out how to take advantage of the things that are out there to inform your practice and to help you figure out all six of those steps that I just want to walk through. It's out there. The challenge is finding it and making sense of it. And if I had an easy way to tell you how to do that, I would tell you. Help is coming. In that, Bill Trocham has been working. I've been a sort of peripheral participant, but been working with a set of students on an NSF-funded project that uses the logic model framework, actually takes it another step, and instead of just saying we have these things going on here and these things going on here, connects in a path model, connects the inputs with the outcomes, and relates those to the research literature. I say it does that. The goal is to have a website in which when you identify a program objective, you can go to the website and find out what does the research say is an effective means of achieving that objective. So you can pull objectives and associated research from the website rather than having to do this all by yourself and develop a logic model that is backed up by the research literature at every point. Now, this is going to take a while, and it's going to take input, because the idea of this website is, as people develop their programs and their logic models and the research behind them, they will put them on the web, and that can then be searchable so that others can come and borrow as well as contributing. And after we've done that for a while, it'll be, it's like a wiki. It's going to be a very powerful and rich resource. That's, for me, that's about the most hopeful development I've seen to help us all deal with this challenge. That, as I say, I recognize myself, despite my very privileged position. I'm going to be provocative now, because I recognize the conflict between what I'm recommending and not only our professional culture, but my own predilections as an extension person. I like to invent programs. I like to try out new things. We reward people who do that kind of work. We give awards to people who do new programs. It doesn't make that much sense if we're talking about being research-based, because new programs, by definition, haven't yet had the research done on them, and very rarely have all of those six steps touched on even before they're used. I think, in fact, we need to be less creative and more imitative, more selective in the things we devote our resources to, so that we can say, not only do I have research-based content, but the way in which I am using it has been tested and has been found to be effective. I'll expect you to push back against that a little bit. But that's my message on research-based.
This has been a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.